Hello, welcome along. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. This is the show where we try to uncover all the secrets that are hidden away out there in the universe. This week, we've actually got a proper science genius, like a bona fide expert, answering one of your questions, the ones that you've sent in to the Apple Podcast Store. Libby Jackson, she's a friend of the show. She's been on before. She works at the UK Space Agency, and she's here in a bit to tell us a little bit more about gravity and why it does what it does. Also, we'll talk about why your dogs can actually be pretty deadly, and we'll check in with one of our old favourites, the Thwaites Glacier. See how that's getting on floating around near the South Pole. We'll do that a little bit later. First, let's get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system. This is Professor Pulsar at Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
So, we've seen that Mars is a pretty interesting place, and Earthlings are certainly very excited about it. Can anyone tell me why?
Is it because there might be aliens there?
That's right. Although from all the probes and robots that have been sent there, we know that there aren't any three-headed monsters. Well, not that we've seen. I wasn't talking about you, Quark. But yes, there are lots of reasons or clues to think there might be life on Mars. Who can remember any of the clues?
Well, even though it's colder than Earth, it's not too freezing or too hot for humans to survive there. And if humans could, maybe other life could too.
Exactly right. After Earth, Mars is the most Earth-like planet in the solar system. It's in something called the Goldilocks zone. It's close enough to the sun to be able to sustain life, not too hot that any life is just blasted away, and not too cold that there's not enough energy for life forms to survive. Any other clues? Anyone? Okay, I'll give you a clue.
It's water.
That's right. The possibility of running water on Mars is a clue that there might be life. We can see patterns in the rock and dark stripes across the land that suggest there were rivers once. And maybe that water is still there, under the surface of the planet. There's another substance that's been found on the planet.
Chocolate?
Nothing so tasty. Well, not for Earth children. It's methane. Methane is a special gas that can be a sign of organic activity. Quark, that is not a special gas.
So why don't Earthlings send some astronauts up there to have a proper look around?
Funnily enough, that is exactly what's planned. A very exciting project called the Aurora Programme is underway. It will send a special robot to Mars called the ExoMars Rover in a special mission to determine if life exists or ever existed on the red planet. NASA and the European Space Agency are working together on developing robots to probe the planet like never before and provide unprecedented data on the history and composition of this fascinating world.
Awesome! Will any human astronauts go with them?
Not at first. Before humans can set foot on Mars, scientists need to know as much as possible about the red planet. What are the dangers to human explorers? How easy is it to live and work on Mars?
And if there's any other special gases?
They'll be fairly easy to find if any exist. The ExoMars rover mission will be followed by a further mission in the 2020s, which will provide data for a planned human mission in the 2030s.
Wow, a human mission. Astronauts on Mars. Hey, in 2030, I'll be a grown-up. Maybe I could lead the mission.
Yes, and get this, kids. There will be Earth children in school right now who might walk on Mars as part of that mission. Exciting stuff, right?
That's so cool. So what will the ExoMars rover be able to do?
Well, the ExoMars rovers will use the very latest technology. Panoramic cameras with enhanced zoom, infrared spectrometers and organic molecule analyzers to test samples. It'll have more gadgets than stats.
No one has more gadgets than me. Not even on a planet as cool as Mars.
Deep Space High, destination Mars. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Exciting times on the Science Weekly. We've got three of your questions being answered on the show this week. Two from me, and we've got one answered by a proper expert in her field, an absolute space genius. She'll be on the show in a little bit. First, and by the way, this is one of the best questions I've ever had. Have a listen to this. It's from Dante, who is 8, lives in Devon, Dante asks, why don't poisonous snakes die when they eat the prey that they have just poisoned? It's amazing, isn't it? This is why you are the best at asking questions. I would never think of asking that. Why don't snakes die when they've eaten the prey that they themselves have poisoned? Now, there are two reasons that I can find of why this is the case, Dante. It's because venom is only poisonous when it's in the bloodstream. Now, first, snakes keep their venom in a special part of the body, in a gland, so it can't get from there into their own bloodstream. When they bite the prey, they inject the venom through their fangs into the prey's bloodstream, so it completely skips theirs. When that animal dies, the snake can safely eat it because the venom can't go from its own stomach back into its own bloodstream. Also, another handy thing, snakes make their own antidote. They have these special immune cells that fight the venom just in case a little amount does get in, but they can only deal with a small amount. And that's why a snake will probably die if it is bitten by another venomous snake. They've not got enough of the antidote to cure themselves when there's quite a large quantity. You see, it's just such an amazing question with such a fascinating answer. Dante, thank you so much for that. Also, another question from someone called How Can I Help? You've not left your proper name. This is the rule, right? If you're going to leave a review for me, if you're going to leave a question, you need to drop your name so I can say hello. You also need to drop us 5 stars. It really helps me see it. How Can I Help? It's only given us 4 stars. Come on, team. But it's quite a fascinating question, so I will answer it anyway. They ask, how are rainbows made? I think we might have touched on this before. It's always worth going over stuff, though. A rainbow is only seen in very special conditions. It has to be where the sun is behind where you're standing, and the rain needs to be in front of you. You see, all the light in the spectrum is contained in a ray of sunlight. And when that sunlight hits the water in front of you at a very specific angle, it's refracted back, which means all the colours that are in that sunlight are kind of broken up. They spread out, which means you can see them all individually. And that's why you get a rainbow. In fact, the rainbow doesn't stop. It goes all the way around. It's a big circle. You just can't see it because of the horizon. A brilliant way to notice that, if you're ever up high in a plane and it's raining and the sun's behind you, if you look down, you can see a massive circle of all the colours in a big ring. So there you go. Thank you so much for that How Can I Help? But remember, next time you've got a question, you need to leave it for me as a review on the Apple Podcast Store. Make sure you drop your name and make sure you give us 5 stars as well. Now remember, if you've got any science question that you want answered on this show, you need to leave it for us as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. Most of the time, I do all the research and the legwork. Sometimes I get a proper expert to help us out, though. This question comes from Sammy, who asks, how does gravity hold us to the planet? So I've given a call to one of the friends of the show who's been with us before, Libby Jackson. She's from the UK Space Agency. She's on the line to help us. Hey, Libby.
Hey, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, Sammy asks, how does gravity hold us to the planet? I imagine this could be done in a one-line answer, but then it could also be done in an answer that takes about a year to explain. So let's start simple. How does gravity hold us to the planet?
Well, what a great question. Really, when you think of it simply, it's because everything that has mass, so everything from you and I to the planet we stand on, to the sun, to the moon, to everything, exerts gravity. It is a pull on everything around it. And the size of that pull depends on the size of the object and how far away you are from the object. So just as the Earth is pulling us towards it, standing on it, and that's why we fall down. We're actually, teeny tiny little bit, pulling the Earth towards us as well. But we don't notice that because the Earth is so big. And so, you know, two people standing next to each other exert a gravitational pull on one another. Two planets do. That's why we see the Earth orbit around the sun. We see the moon orbit around the Earth. All of these orbits, all of these things are because of gravity. And the first person who really sort of figured out the laws of what was happening here and wrote down some equations to explain how all of this works was somebody called Sir Isaac Newton, who was around in the 1600s.
Now, That's why gravity exists. But the next, well, that's what gravity is, rather. And the next question then has to be, why do objects do this? Why does something with mass pull another object with mass towards it?
Well, there you go. Sir Isaac Newton didn't really explain that or figure it out.
That was nice of him.
Sorry?
That was nice of him to have this idea. Like, you know what? You can do this. That's fine.
Sir Isaac Newton just sort of wrote down what he saw was happening and wrote. It took until Albert Einstein came along in the early 1900s, and he came up with it with a slightly different theory, which is it's called relativity, and it's really complicated, and it's something that I used to understand a little bit more at university, and now I think you've got to be. So you've got to be a real, really into physics and get really, really into it to figure out and really understand some of these concepts. But I can try and explain it very briefly. What Albert Einstein said was that we're all living in this thing called space-time. Now, we know what space is. We can all imagine, as we move around a room, that we can go forwards and backwards and jump up and down. And that's what we call three-dimensional. And then if you think really hard, you can imagine time. And we know that sort of time moves forward. And what I've said now has happened after what I said before. And we can think about the future and the past. And so anything that happens, happens in a given moment of time. And if you think about space and then you think about space moving through time, you start to kind of maybe get an idea of what this space-time is. And it's where space and time all gets wrapped into each other. And what Albert Einstein thought was that gravity is a result of curvature in this space-time, an object traveling through this mesh. Bends space-time around it. Now, that is really hard to imagine and really hard to understand and explain. But one of the great ways that people use to try and show what this is like a little bit is to imagine a giant rubber sheet stretched over a sort of ring. If you imagine that and you put a sort of heavy ball in the middle of it, you can imagine that that's going to bend the rubber sheet and curve it. And any object then that you put on that rubber sheet is going to be, it's going to move towards that big ball in the center. And you can put it on and it would just fall straight down. Or you can push it sideways a bit and it will spiral down and in and in and in towards this big ball in the center. And if you can imagine that, you're sort of imagining a little bit what happens with space-time and why an object in it would cause it to bend. And Albert Einstein said, well, this is gravity. That's what it is. Now, I still start to go, whoa, this all starts to make a lot of sense to me. But one of the, people say, so how can we know this is true and what happens? And one of the things that Einstein's theories predicted was that you would get waves, ripples in this space-time continuum. And they're called gravitational waves. And what he said was that, as he figured out, what he thought was that if two really, really giant, big, massive objects were to collide, and we're talking things as massive as black holes, which can be absolutely enormous. If two black holes were to collide, then you would see such a massive force that you would see ripples through this space-time, which we would see as gravitational waves. You imagine waves on a sea or a pond or something. If you throw something really big into the water, you get the ripples and it goes across. And this was just an idea, but the brilliant scientists around the world actually got together and came up with this thing called LIGO. And this was a way to detect these gravitational waves. And what you're looking at is a ripple by the time they get to Earth. It is something that is teeny, teeny, tiny. It's thousands of times smaller than the nucleus of the atom, the bit in the middle of atoms that makes everything up. It's teeny tiny. And it blows my mind to think about it, but the engineers and scientists figured out a way how to do this. And just in the last few years, in about 5 years ago, in 2015, the scientists with these instruments detected one of these gravitational waves from two colliding black holes. And so we're starting to get some many more sort of direct evidence that Albert Einstein was right. And it's so crazy to think about it, and it's so difficult. But it seems like Albert Einstein's theories are being proved right.
That's amazing, isn't it? That this guy, I mean, obviously this guy, one of the smartest guys that has ever lived, is sat there with chalk on a blackboard working stuff out without even being into space, and half of it's turning out to be true. Listen, Libby, at the UK Space Agency, with everything that you do with astronauts and in space, how much thought do you have to give to what gravity does when you are designing things or when you're sending people up to space?
So when we are looking at humans going to the International Space Station, these sorts of things, we have to think really carefully about gravity. But we, fortunately for me, I don't have to wrap my head around Albert Einstein's work, because Sir Isaac Newton's equations are still very good for working out how quickly or how often the space station is going to go around or something like that. But when you're going to launch an astronaut and get them to the International Space Station, or when you're going to launch a rocket and you want it to go and visit a planet or get a satellite into orbit in the right place, you still have to work out the time and the force and all of these things. And it's a great big math problem to make sure that you can get to the right place at the right time. And gravity is absolutely a part of that equation. And we're working out the forces needed to accelerate off the Earth and to sort of outrun that pull back down to Earth. But we've also got scientists who are working on missions that are going to study the solar system and study the universe. We're looking at hunting for planets out in around other stars. We've got things that are looking at the sun, and we've got people who, scientists who have been involved in these missions that are trying to study gravity. There was a mission called LISA Pathfinder that was also trying to look at Einstein's laws and gravity that was built here in the UK. So there's loads of different things going on, from the scientists who study gravity to the engineers who just need to make sure that we understand it so that we can get our spacecraft into the right time at the right place. Gravity really is something that none of us can ignore any day, just from sitting in our seats and making sure we don't fall over.
Amazing. Well, there you go, Sammy. That's your question answered. Libby, thank you so much. Because you've done such a sterling job at actually making that slightly clearer for us, you have a book out. It's A Galaxy of Her Own, which is all about amazing stories of women in space. Just give us a little example of what's in the book.
Well, there are 50 stories. The world of human spaceflight is not just about astronauts. We have doctors and lawyers and people who look after the food that astronauts eat, people who design the spacecraft, loads of different jobs. And the book talks about 50 or tells 50 stories of women who were part of human spaceflight, because sometimes people think that space is just for boys, and that's not true at all. It's for everybody. And so whether you are interested in astronauts or whether you're interested in just space in general, if it's something that excites you and interests you, there is definitely a job for you in the industry somewhere. So keep working hard and keep learning about things and come and work for the space industry one day.
There you go. The book is absolutely well worth it. If you're interested in all of this, you should go and grab a copy and a coffee as well. It's A Galaxy of Her Own. Libby Jackson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Now, this week's Dangerous Dan is all about how even your dog can be pretty deadly. Let me tell you about Capnocytophaga. It's a bacteria that about three quarters of dogs have, but it doesn't cause an illness in them. But in some rare cases, it can transfer over to humans when it gets in through bites or through scratches. And it can have some serious consequences. Most people are already at risk from this because they've got a... Well, if they've got a weakened immune system, then they are more at risk. And it is incredibly rare that it does happen, that it does transfer over to humans. But when it does, the bacteria can cause some serious damage. Like the case of a man in America almost 2 years ago. His dog would lick his face pretty much every day. And one day, he was rushed to the hospital with what he thought was the flu. You see, this bacteria, Capnocytophaga, it can cause infection, which then causes sepsis. Now, sepsis is when the immune system in your body, when it overreacts to it in infection, it kind of fights the battles on all fronts. You get inflammation across the body, you get blisters, swelling, fever, headache, muscle pain, you vomit all the time. You can understand why this guy thought that it might have been the flu. The problem was, by the time he was in hospital, it was too late. The infection had caused his blood pressure to drop so dramatically that his arms and legs stopped getting blood, and that caused them to start rotting, and then they had to be amputated. It's horrible, it's tragic. It's all because of Capnocytophaga, the bacteria that means maybe you love your dog just too much. This week has been a whole episode full of getting your questions answered. And let's get some more of them now with Techno Mum. She's always here to answer all of your gadgety questions.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology.
Welcome back to Tech Trivia, the game show that tests the technical talents of our tremendous contestants. And playing this week, it's Techno Mum.
Hi, great to be here.
Now I know you're keen to show us how brainy you are, so get ready, set, and spin the wheel! And the category is design. Your time starts now. Your first question. Why is design important in technology?
Well, that's an easy one. Anything that's engineered, whether it's a space-age mattress or a smartwatch, they all have a job to do. And design helps ensure that products do their job in the most efficient way, as well as looking and feeling nice. Like if you pick up a tablet computer, chances are you'll know how to use it without being shown. You're not a genius, or you might be, but that's not the reason why. Designers have worked hard to make these gadgets super easy to use, from the choices of buttons to click to its colour and weight. Making gadgets feel nice in your hand or look attractive means that more people will want to use them. Design is super creative.
A strong start, Techno Mum. Next question. Give us an example of some dazzling design.
Well, what about the Google Virtual Reality Viewer? It looks just like a bit of flat cardboard. But when it's used with a smartphone and a clever app, the cardboard can be folded into a personal VR viewer. How amazing is that?
Definitely cool enough for another point. Final question now, and it's a tough one. Name some cool design jobs, as many as you can now, before you run out of time.
Okay, well, there's computer game designers. Who wouldn't want to do that? Making the game look exciting so people will want to join in. And it's not just games which need designing. What about the devices? Designers have to think about the responsiveness of the screen, as well as its size, weight, and how much power it uses. And if you like games in the real world, what about a roller coaster designer? Just think, you could invent a ride that's bigger, higher, scarier than any roller coaster that's ever been made before. Oh, here's an amazing job. Some people are medical engineering designers. They create actual body parts out of human tissue. You definitely want a good designer in charge of something like that. Imagine if they made you a new ear that was all big and floppy. Your glasses would fall off.
Oh, I have to stop you there. Strong start, Techno Mum. And with that stunning performance, you're through to the next round.
Ooh, I could have gone on for ages.
So make sure you join us tomorrow for the next round of Tech Trivia.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology. Find out more at funkidslive.com/tech-trivia.
Right, let's do this week's Science in the News. Icefin, a bright yellow robot submarine, has reached the Thwaites Glacier. We've spoken about this one before. Glaciologists have said that it's the most important glacier in the world. It's roughly the size of Britain. It's absolutely massive. And they call it the Doomsday Glacier because there's enough water locked in it to raise world sea level by more than half a metre if it were to melt. And half a metre is a lot of water. It's pretty devastating. So Icefin is there taking tests and getting to know it. Also, India's top court has said cheetahs can be reintroduced to the country 70 years after they died out. Some African cheetahs will be moved into the wild in India in carefully chosen locations. There are only 7,100 cheetahs left in the world in the wild, and they're being reintroduced slowly back there to Indian conditions to hopefully they will thrive. And finally, there's growing alarm in East Africa about huge swarms of locusts which are sweeping the region. They're destroying vegetation, they're causing a food crisis because of that, and it's the worst invasion of desert locusts in 25 years. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Look, this episode has been more proof than any other that your questions can get answered by some of the best science minds on the planet. So, if you've got something that you want answered on this show, a little science nugget that's kind of niggling at your brain, you want it confirmed, you want it disproved, you need to fire it over to me as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on the Apple Podcast Store. Make sure you leave your name and 5 stars. We had that issue earlier on. There's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. And as you've seen, either I will do the legwork or I will get a proper genius in the field to come on and explain it for you. When you're on the Apple Podcast Store, we've got so many of our brilliant science series that you can hear on there as well. You've heard some today. We've got tons more. You can also get them on the free Fun Kids app, on Google, on Spotify. You can find them at funkidslive.com as well. Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. I'll see you next week, where we're chatting to the adventurer and the TV presenter as well, Ben Fogle.